I'm Rick Gamley. This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Elder abuse has long been a hidden problem and is most often perpetrated by those closest to the victim, children, grandchildren, friends, and even spouses. But several efforts in recent years have started to bring this issue out of the shadows. Since the late 2000s, New Hampshire has had a specific unit within the Attorney General's office devoted to crimes against seniors. In 2010, the Affordable Care Act included a sizable chunk of money for programs to prevent and prosecute elder abuse. And just this spring, a national group called the Elder Justice Coordinating Council released a wide-ranging list of recommendations, such as better tracking of these cases, more public education, and even creation of a national resource center aimed at tackling these crimes. All this increased attention has already led to more awareness and therefore more reports of elder abuse. Still, it will remain a tough one to solve, given the complex family dynamics that are often involved. Today in The Exchange, we explore this issue of elder abuse, what it is, how it happens, as well as new efforts to expose it and prevent it. And let's hear from you. Have you seen cases of elder abuse in your own family or in your own community? How common do you think this really is? How hard is it to spot? And what might be the best way to prevent this? Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page. We have three guests for the hour. L. Renee Bergeron is here, Associate Professor of Social Work at UNH. Her research focus is on elder maltreatment, neglect, and exploitation, and the ways that practitioners can intervene in these cases. And Renee Bergeron, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Rachel Lakin, Adult Protection Program Administrator at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. And Rachel, it's good to have you too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And joining us from the D.C. area is Stephanie Eliason. She's the Elder Rights Team Lead at the U.S. Health and Human Services Department. And Stephanie, welcome and thank you for your time as well.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, Stephanie, I did want to start with you. You know, we talk a lot as a society about child abuse, about domestic violence. What about elder abuse, Stephanie? How aware do you think most Americans are that this even goes on?
Unfortunately, we don't think that enough people are aware of elder abuse as a problem that needs to be addressed. We often compare it to how people view domestic violence 20, 30, even 40 years ago, that it was a family problem, it was private, they would look the other way, not think to call authorities. So unfortunately, we think people really aren't as aware as they need to be that this is a problem. In many states, it's a crime. There are units like in New Hampshire that can prosecute and really come to the defense and the aid of the older person who's a victim.
Yeah, that's interesting. So the way that we used to look at domestic violence two or three decades ago, well, that's their business. You're saying that's how we look at elder abuse today.
Yes, a lot of times it is. And in a lot of jurisdictions, unfortunately, they don't have the laws or the policies on the books that would allow them to address it.
Well, and given how private then it tends to be and underreported, do we have any measurements at all, Stephanie, of how widespread this is nationally?
We have some. There have been a few studies recently, national, one study that was done in a state that looks like it is representative of the country. Looks like it's estimated to be about 7 to 10% of the population would experience elder abuse, neglect, or exploitation in 1 year.
Wow, that's a lot. 7 to 10%.
It is.
In a big country like this. You know, I want to bring our New Hampshire guests into this, too. And I wonder, Rachel, do you have any numbers, ideas of how big this is?
Well, what we have that's reported to us, last year our unit received over 8,000 calls. Not all of those calls actually resulted in adult abuse or elder abuse, but were calls of concerns. We investigated approximately 1,600 calls involving elder abuse here in New Hampshire. And whenever I look at the national data and compare it to the statistics that we have in New Hampshire, we fall in line pretty much with what's going on nationally.
Yeah, and I'm interested, Renee, in Stephanie's analysis with how we used to regard domestic violence, you know, 30 years ago. What do you think? How do we regard this issue of elder abuse right now?
Well, I think it's really just coming to the forefront. Elder abuse has had to fight many social conflicting values, ageism being one of them. They don't care, older people don't carry the worth that children do or that younger women and men do. Our research has not been as good as those other two categories, so we know less about it, when in fact elder abuse is probably more complicated than any other form of abuse. You're dealing with an aging body that many people that interface with elder abuse don't understand. We're dealing with complex family systems. Many times the elder person will say, I want the abuse to stop, but I don't want to see my son go to jail or my husband go to jail. They want to preserve that family unit. Many times the laws are written in a way that inhibit that from happening. Laws are written to protect the victim, the alleged victim. They're not written to preserve the family unit and thus work with the perpetrator or the alleged perpetrator. So it's fascinating and it's complex. And those that don't go into elder abuse work because they think that it isn't going to be very interesting, making a huge mistake. You're working with family systems and cultures that are different, even though their complexion may be the same as ours, very different the way they view caregiving. So it's complex, and you're also dealing with an age right now that they want to be independent. And so the adult protective worker has to not only get through to the older person, but has to be able to stay with them long enough that they hear their story.
Because many elderly people, most elderly people, correct me if I'm wrong, live at home. So it's not like a assisted living area where, you know, there's multiple people keeping an eye on a person.
That's correct.
I want to invite our listeners to join us and then get into more what you just talked about, Renee, the incredible complexity of this issue. The number for you to join us here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Join us as we talk about elder abuse. If you have questions about what this really means, whether you've seen cases of it in your own family, your own community, how common do you think this is, and what do you think might be the best way to prevent it? We'd love to hear from you this hour, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, you can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Stephanie Eliason, could you follow up, please, on what Renee said? You know, there are a lot of factors at play here when you're trying to determine what the abuse is and the extent of it.
Certainly. Well, actually, I have a question. Are you asking more about maybe what it, how we might be able to identify it, what it might look like if we see something?
Yeah, we can start with that, and then I've got a couple more questions. Sure.
Sure, absolutely. There are actually a number of what we would call warning signs, what it might actually look like. And for instance, you know, financial exploitation, that one seems to be a little bit more in people's minds when they think of abuse, neglect, or exploitation. And generally that's when someone's funds, no matter how limited their money is, their Social Security check, any small pension they might have, when those funds are used for somebody else's benefit rather than the older person. And you can see that as maybe the caregiver starts to take control of the money, but the elder no longer is getting the things that they need. physical abuse, that one might be a little bit more obvious. There's the bruising, unexplained sexually transmitted diseases, unfortunately, could be a sign of abuse as well. And then the one that's most difficult, I think, to tackle is neglect. When a senior is lacking the things that they need, food, basic hygiene, medication, being left alone for too long, the home is dirty. But that one's more difficult. A senior might say, well, or they might think a senior just can't get around, can't do it. But then the question arises, well, is there someone there to take care of them, to help them with these things? What's happening in the home? These should all be signs that someone should, a friend, a neighbor, a family member should start to question what's going on.
Yeah, neglect is a tough one. You're right. And give us a little bit more on that, Stephanie. You know, when you see obvious signs of neglect, you have to kind of ask, well, whose fault is it? You know, does the elderly person need to ask for help? Is it the spouse's fault if the spouse is still living? Is it the children? That's a tough one, isn't it?
It is a tough one. And we try to be careful of the word fault, actually, because sometimes that will stop someone from really asking the questions that because of the how loaded the term might be. We should really see just what's going on. Is there someone who had who had taken on the duty or the responsibility to help provide care? Sometimes a senior lives by themselves. Many times they do. They are failing to give themselves these things. They don't clean their home. They start to do what we call hoarding. They collect a lot of things. Their home becomes very messy. They're not getting medication. So that would be the senior. We call that self-neglect, where they're failing to provide for themselves the things that they need to stay healthy and to live in a safe environment. But then we have the situation where other people have assumed a responsibility to help with the care. And what's happening there? Is someone just not informed enough or educated? Do they not have the knowledge that they need to provide what the senior needs? Do they understand that someone who can't get up and move on their own, who has limited mobility, does the caregiver understand how they need to help that older adult move or turn over so that they don't have developed those pressure sores or that their muscles don't atrophy.
And Stephanie, I'm going to jump in there. We're going to go to a quick break and we'll pick up on this topic in just a minute. Stay with us.
Good morning. It's 9:19 and you're invited to join NHPR in the Music Hall in Portsmouth as we begin a new season of Writers on a New England Stage. NHPR's Virginia Prescott will be sitting down with several noted authors, including Margaret Atwood, Bill Bryson, and U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. Take a look at the full schedule and get your tickets at nhpr.org. Turning partly to mostly sunny across New Hampshire this afternoon, highs from lower 60s in Coos County ranging to around 70 along the Massachusetts border. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the Common Man Restaurants, supporting the New Hampshire Lakes Association's Guinness World Record attempt at Weir's Beach on Saturday, September 7th. Information at nhlakefest.org. And from Liberty Utilities, helping homeowners convert oil or propane heating systems to natural gas before fall. Details on conversion programs at libertyutilities.com/east/warm welcome. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at elder abuse, what it looks like, efforts to prevent it. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We have three guests with us for the hour. L. Renee Bergeron, she's at UNH. Stephanie Eliason, she's at the U.S. Health and Human Services Department. And Rachel Lakin, she's with the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. And Rachel, I want to bring you back into this too. You know, just before the break, Stephanie was talking about the types of abuse. Financial exploitation, pretty easy to understand. Physical abuse, you know, you can pretty much spot it. But Stephanie was talking about neglect, both neglect by assigned caregivers and then the issue of self-neglect by the elder person. Talk a little bit about how you folks at the department work through this issue of neglect.
Sure. I would like to just say that, self-neglect certainly is the cases that get reported to us. We last year, I told you that we had over 1,600 reports that we investigated. Of those, almost 1,100 were categorically self-neglect. And so that is a huge problem for us. And it usually does involve people that live alone, that some folks may have some type of dementia process in play, so they may be doing things like leaving the stove on and, you know, maybe having a fire, maybe wandering in cold weather. And so we often get calls, and we can get calls from neighbors, police departments, home care agencies. We get calls from all over the place when people see an elder that's not doing well. And it is difficult. As Renee had mentioned earlier, that, you know, people want to remain independent. They really don't really welcome us at times. And so we you know, go into the home and really try to meet with the person and see what we can do to help remedy that concern and see who's around to help. Are there family members around that can help that individual? Sometimes those family members have been struggling, you know, for
well,
a long time
they,
trying to help.
They say, yes, I want to help, but mom or dad won't let me. Exactly. Just give us an example. It doesn't need to be a real life one, but an example of, okay, so what the people at your agency do, again, the Adult Protection Program Administration. So you get a report of self-neglect by an elderly person. A neighbor, a loved one is really worried about this person. You knock on the door and they say, no, thank you, I'm fine.
Yeah, well, and we have to be very persistent in these cases and really address with them the issue that came to our attention. And, you know, we try to really meet the client where he or she is at and, you know, figure out some things that they might accept help with and keep going back. Sometimes we have to go back several times before somebody will accept services or accept whatever it is that they need to fix the issue that they are contending with.
Wow. And this is an area of your expertise, really, Renee, isn't it? Again, the way that practitioners intervene with older folks who are being neglected by others or are neglecting themselves.
Yes, and I think what's sometimes hard for practitioners is they have their goals. They know what really needs to change in order to make an environment low in risk. But then the person who is older, the alleged victim, they have their own ideas.
Give us an example.
Well, one example might be going into the home of an elder that has been a hoarder, and they have just collected. It's very unhealthy. There might be rats. There might be feces in the house in addition to a lot of stuff. And so I go in and I say, my God, they got to get rid of the dogs. They got to get rid of the cats. They've got to clean out this house. That's a huge goal to ask of this person. And so you try to find out what are they willing to do. And maybe they're only willing to clean off the stovetop so that they won't start a fire. And you help them do that. And you begin to gain trust because you're not forcing them to do something else. Or you get them to make a good path to two doorways in case there's a fire.
So they
won't
trip, yeah.
Yeah. And so you begin with the little, and you may never get to the big. But I think the job of the APS worker is to reduce risk. And so you take a look, and you have your practitioner goals, but you kind of put them aside, and you say, what can I do here that will make this person a little safer?
Let's take some calls, and then I have a lot more questions for all of you. The number here in the exchange, again, is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we're trying to untangle the complex problem of elder abuse. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And all of you, let's go first to Brattleboro, Vermont, where Linda's been waiting. Hi, Linda. Thanks for hanging on.
Thank you. My question is about a couple who are still working and very viable and still able to take care of themselves, but are being, I feel, financially abused by their adult son. But they would deny it, I think, if a social worker were to come to their house. What would happen in a case like that? How could they be helped?
That's so hard, isn't it, Linda, to get someone to admit that a person they might love is doing them wrong. Stephanie, what do you think? Linda, thanks a lot for the call.
Hi. That is a very difficult situation. And one of the things that you have to weigh is how much does the older adult understand what's happening? Are they being manipulated and influenced, being exercised over them, where they don't really understand kind of what's happening, or again, they're sort of being like emotionally blackmailed or something like that? But then again, the difficulty is that sometimes older adults, they say, you know what, I've lived my whole life. I'm not going to be around that much longer. I want my children or my grandkids or whomever to have what they need, because I was never able to have that. I want to give that to them. So to us on the outside, we might think, but don't you realize that they're just taking advantage of you? And the older adult may actually say, well, they're asking for something that I have no problem giving. But at other times, they are being emotionally blackmailed. They can't see the grandkids unless they, you know, buy the new car, or they can't visit, or they won't be allowed to do one thing or another unless the money is given to, or help is given to the family member. It's very complicated, and that's one of the things I think that that overlays everything we talk about, is that an older adult that it is not cognitively impaired, does not have dementia, they have the right to make bad decisions. We have to try to help figure out what's going on. Are they being unduly manipulated and influenced, or are they just exercising their right to make decisions we don't agree with? It's very complicated.
Yeah, well, and that's the difference with child abuse, really. I mean, children, we're in charge of them as adults. But Stephanie makes such a good point in a way, Rachel. Older adults do have the right to make, as she said, bad decisions.
Yeah, and what a pieces of our job is to really figure out, do they understand that decision? Are they really able to grasp the consequences of that decision? And so maybe they are giving their money to their children, and maybe that means then that they're not able to meet their own bills and pay their own bills or get their other necessities. And so that's a conversation we can have with them and explore with them and, help figure out a way that maybe we can stop them from giving the money so that they can have their own needs met. In other cases, you know, that's not the case. They have plenty of money to, you know, to do that with, and they want to do that. And there's not much we're going to be able to do to impact that. But I think it's important to really, assess the elder and make sure that they're really aware of what their decision is and how that's going to play out for them, not only in the short term, but in the long term as well.
Well, and with people living much, much longer, they may need that money
that's
to get them
correct.
Up until their late 80s and 90s. So here we have Linda, our caller, who's saying, what can someone do? I mean, how would someone even get started if they had a concern?
Well, I think what I want to stress to people is that we do have a mandated reporting requirement in New Hampshire, so that if anybody does suspect somebody is being abused or neglected or self-neglecting, under our statute, they are to report. And I'd like to give that number. That number is 1-800-949-0470. And we accept calls that are from anonymous reporters. We do encourage people to give us their name and contact information in case we need to get back to them, and we would hold that information confidential. So whenever anybody has a concern, please feel free to pick up the phone and give us a call. It may not be something that we would investigate, but certainly it may be something that we can help give some advice to the caller as to where to go with their concern if it's not us.
And if you didn't catch that 800 number, we'll put it on our website, nhpr.org. Thank you for the call, Linda, and good luck. The number 1-800-892-6477. That's our number here in the Exchange. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email that came in, and this person asked to be anonymous, so I will respect that. This person says, is there a way for one sibling to protect the elder parents' funds from another sibling? I have a half-brother with substance abuse and mental health issues who constantly seeks monetary support, gifts, co-signing of loans from my mother, who's now 85. It's becoming more and more difficult to protect her from the emotional pressure he inflicts upon her. Thank you for your insights. And I want to thank that person for the email. And Renee, what do you think? There's a lot in this email. I guess one thing that comes up for me is I have read that substance abuse and mental health issues on the part of the adult children is a huge issue in elder abuse.
It is. It's a well-known factor. One thing that this child can do is actually seek legal advice. And they could get that through adult protection service workers, where to go, who is trained in geriatric law, and get help through there. It certainly sounds like in that situation a guardianship is needed, or at least having this alcoholic son restricted from having access to any of the funds. But again, family dynamics are hard. I don't know the history here. You know, does this son have some kind of developmental disorder where the parents feel very obligated, maybe for things not done in the past? Or are the parents acting out of fear of this son? Has he threatened them? Whether physically or emotionally, saying, I'll never see you again if you don't give me some money.
That's heartbreaking.
It's very heartbreaking. And so the task of the worker, the practitioner, is to really get into the family dynamics. You can't just interview the alleged victims. You have to also interview the alleged perpetrator. And that's part of the New Hampshire law, isn't it, Rachel?
That's correct.
And so you begin to get a fuller picture. Sometimes in these cases, if the adult child knows that there is another person there, that will act as a way of mitigating some of the financial abuse. Other times, if the parents are competent, you know, there may not be much that you can do except try to get them to limit it. Maybe you can actually set up an amount. Give Johnny $500 a month.
And that's it.
And that's it.
You know, a couple times this hour, all three of you have touched on what the laws say, what the laws do. How different, Stephanie, are laws regarding elder abuse from state to state?
Oh, they're very different. We don't have a national framework for laws for elder abuse like we do for child abuse. So every state determines based on what the citizens and the lawmakers of the state think is right for them. They all set up their own different laws and rules and regulations for as to whether elder abuse is actually treated as a crime and how is it treated as a crime, all the way to how adult protective services can intervene in a case. What is that threshold for intervention? Who are the people that adult protective services can serve? So it varies widely from state to state. There's no hard and fast or general rule of how elder abuse is treated across the country.
And why do you suppose that's the case, Stephanie?
Well, it's a state-based program, and it developed as a state-based program, and it's continued as a state-based program. And even though, as you mentioned at the top of the hour, we have the Affordable Care Act in 2010 that established the Elder Justice Act that does establish some authority for the federal government to begin to work in this area, but it doesn't set forth a national legal framework. And unfortunately, I wouldn't be the best person to speak about that. I'm not an attorney, and I don't understand those things. But again, APS continues to be a state-based program, and that's why it varies from state to state.
APS, again, being Adult Protective Services, is that right? Yeah.
Yes.
And that's your line of work again, Rachel. What do you think? I mean, boy, given the complexities of all these family dynamics that we've talked about and that Renee just outlined, can laws really even make a difference there?
I think so. Our statute is certainly a civil statute. It's not a criminal statute. It has given us the ability to access victims or clients that wouldn't normally be able to come forward for services or for help and to try to help them.
Can you just back up there? So what does that mean, or what's the importance of that, that it's civil, not criminal?
Well, so we conduct an investigation, and we may have a finding of abuse or neglect. That doesn't necessarily mean that somebody's criminally charged.
I see. So the son or daughter won't go to jail, right. And that may make the older parent feel better about discussing
correct.
It.
Okay. Correct, exactly. And that's important. A lot of times we go out and see folks and they say, well, what's going to happen? And they're concerned whether, I don't want to get anybody in trouble. I don't want to see my son go to jail. And so under our statute, that's not something that we deal with. Now, certainly if we see something that meets the threshold of, a crime, we need to report that to law enforcement, and law enforcement will then step in and do whatever they need to do with that. And sometimes we work very concurrently with law enforcement on some of these cases. And our focus would be looking at the alleged victim and making sure that we're providing the safety and support to that victim that he or she needs through the process.
So it sounds like in a lot of these cases, Rachel, it's not so much, we're going to file charges and so forth, but we're going to work with the family. We're going to work with the elder, especially in these cases of neglect, which, as I understand, is a lot of these cases.
That's correct.
All right. 1-800-892-6477 is our number, the email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an email from Robert in Peterborough. He says, you might mention how important it is for the caregivers of seniors to take care of themselves. Relating to a senior, even someone you love, can be challenging and frustrating if there are factors such as dementia. There's even more frustration. Having regular occasions for personal time, hiring professional and trained caregivers to give family members a break, having friends come in to take care of mom and dad for a couple hours while the son and daughter get some time away, learning that it can be helpful not to argue with someone with dementia can be quite helpful. And maybe after a short break, we'll talk a little bit more about caregiver stress, how that plays into this. We'll also take a lot more of your calls, 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR. It's 9:39. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the struggle for power among opposition forces in Syria. Then, understanding gender nonconforming children. All coming up on The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Hypertherm, an associate-owned manufacturer of metal cutting equipment made in New Hampshire and sold worldwide, hypertherm.com. And from PSU's Division of Online and Continuing Studies, helping you earn your degree evenings online and or days with a schedule that meets your needs. Plymouth.edu/DOCS. Turning partly to mostly sunny across New Hampshire this afternoon. Today's highs from lower 60s in Coos County ranging to around 70 toward the Massachusetts border. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Email us your thoughts on the top news of the week before the program at exchange@nhpr.org. And be sure to join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about elder abuse, both nationally and here in the Granite State, what it looks like, new efforts to prevent it. We'd like to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Put a comment on our Facebook page or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Renee Bergeron, just before the break, I read an email from Robert. And Robert, thank you for this. And he talked about the importance of caregivers getting a break, especially those who are taking care of loved ones with dementia. What do you think?
Oh, sure. We have a term for that. It's called compassion fatigue. And the old term was called burnout. And it happens not only to family members, but it happens to professional, you know, formal caregivers. It happens to practitioners going out trying to resolve the case. You see so many very sad cases. The prime thing that people have to do who are in these situations as caregivers is they have to learn how to take care of themselves, and they have to learn the process of elder abuse. Those are two things that they should do in order to help protect themselves. We spend more time learning about what breed of dog to buy than we do learning about the forms of elder abuse and why they occur, even though they may be occurring in their own family. Caregiver support groups are usually a very helpful thing for people to go to in order to draw support and information and resources.
Yeah, it's tough, though. Boy, if you're working, maybe you have children of your own, and you're taking care of your elderly mother, and you're supposed to find time to go to a support group. It's hard.
It's tough. It's very tough.
I know you want to jump in, too, on this, Rachel, and then we'll go back to our listeners.
Sure. I just wanted to say, when our adult protective social workers in New Hampshire go out and see a alleged victim of abuse or neglect, and if that person has a caregiver or what we call a primary support person, we look at their needs as well, and we do that through a very formal process. We conduct a safety assessment upon our first visit with an elder to really look at what are the safety concerns in the situation, not only for the client but for their caregiver. And then we also look, we have another assessment that we do called the strengths and needs, where we look at both what are the strengths and needs of the client as well as their caregiver, and how do we address those for both those individuals, because we recognize the importance of caregivers in this whole process and the importance of caregiver well-being.
Well, let's go back to our listeners. And Bill is joining us from Plymouth. Hi, Bill. Thanks for waiting. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Sure. I'll have to ask one now. But I'm wondering, I understand and I appreciate the idea that we have to take care of victims of crime, or if you don't want to call it a crime, but a victim of abuse. I'm concerned, though, about the idea of the concept of self-neglect, because there are plenty of people, I'm 45, and there are people in my age group that live a way that I wouldn't choose to live, but it's their choice. And I'm wondering at what point the state feels that it's allowed to get involved in the lives of people who are making decisions of how they want to live their lives. And I think that it just seems to encroach on the liberties of people that may be competent enough. Maybe that's something that you may not want to have 100 cats in your house, and I wouldn't. And I just think that there's an issue with that, and I take issue with the idea that that's acceptable for the state to do that, and I hope that's not the case where people are being infringed upon.
Yeah, you know, and it's a good point. And Bill, this is something, Stephanie, you mentioned earlier. You know, adults do have the right to make their own decisions. Can you address Bill's concern, Stephanie?
Absolutely. The states, as they set up their adult protective services provisions, always err on the side of not getting involved, that older adults do have the right to self-determination, to make bad decisions, to live as independent individuals. New Hampshire and up in New England, the laws, you know, will be different than in another state. But in general, if an older adult does understand the consequences of their decisions, if they have mental capacity, they're competent, they understand what's going on, in general, states cannot get involved in that. They can try to help educate an older adult. They can try to spend, you know, regular
visit the older adult at regular intervals, encourage them to do things that will benefit them, but they can't force the issue. It's not until an older adult really doesn't understand that if they don't take their medication, they could die. If they continue to live outside in sub-zero temperatures, they will freeze to death. It's when the older adult doesn't understand the consequences of what they're doing, that's when the door is open for state adult protective services to be involved.
Interesting. Bill, thank you very much for the point. Do you want
Can
to jump
I
in
just
there,
add
too?
One
yeah,
point.
Go ahead, Renee.
I have been looking at this issue where self overrides community. We have an obligation to the community that we live in. And so while I might have the right to collect 11 cats, if indeed it's proposing a health risk to my neighbors, I really don't have that right. If what I collect is making my home a fire hazard that could indeed prevent a danger to the community I'm living in, I really should not have that right. So there are limits to what we do individually, or there should be, because we also have an obligation to the community that we live in. So I sometimes take a little harder view than what Bill has, because age wouldn't make a difference. If you were 25 and setting up a hazardous situation for the community, there should be an intervention. So age should be taken in some ways out of this paradigm and, you know, looking at self-risk, community risk.
Do you want to jump in there real quickly, Rachel? Because, again, this
I
is
do.
What you folks do.
Yeah, and this is very common situation that we run into. And we do exactly what Dr. Bergeron was speaking about. We look at what is the harm to the community, to other people, or is it just posing harm to that individual and not impacting anybody else? And, again, as Stephanie said, does that person understand the harm that's present, and then what do we do if it's, you know, it may not be an issue for APS, but it may be an issue for the local health officer to contend with, and so then we would need our obligation would be to contact that individual and have them look at the situation.
Bill, thanks for the call. Let's take another one. This is Karen in Laconia. Hi, Karen. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thank you. My question overlaps a little with the last one. You'd mentioned the self-neglect and hoarding situations in particular involving pets. And I was thinking that must put the people who investigate into an awkward position, especially if the animals are suffering or dying, you know, and trying to work with the individual to understand that, and also the health of the individual and community health. Do they report it to animal cruelty, animal control, or if a regular citizen observes something that they think could be an animal cruelty situation with an older person, should we call Adult Protective Services or the local animal control? What would be the appropriate course of action for
I
that?
I see. And Karen, is this something that you're seeing in your neighborhood? Or?
Well, I have once in the past talked someone into giving me a kitten that was dying, and I was able to save it. But others had not made it. And it was a very sad situation. And this was years ago. But I was just wondering how they handle that and how they recommend regular citizens handle it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Karen. And I think I'll have to turn to you again, Rachel. Go ahead.
Sure. I would suggest that you call both the Humane Society and Adult Protective Services. Usually, if animals aren't doing well, the individual is not doing well as well. And we do work with humane societies and other entities when we come across this situation, and we've had some very, very positive outcomes by doing that. I can think of a case that I personally worked on where, I went in and there were several cats and even, a dead cat, and was able to have the elder agree that I could call the Humane Society, which I did. They came in and they took all the cats and they got a couple of the cats healthy and returned them to the elder. So she had a couple. She was very happy about that. Everybody else was happy that the other cats were getting the care they needed. And it is interesting how animals do pull at our heartstrings, and a lot of times the calls that we get do involve animals as well.
Well, and it's often said that having an animal is good for an older person. Right. They feel isolated, and it's good to have that companionship. Yeah. So, but it kind of depends on how many sometimes.
How many and a person's ability to care for the number of animals that they have.
Thanks, Karen, for that call. Yeah,
I did a survey of students at the university, and they were more apt to report animal maltreatment than they were to report people abuse. Very interesting. So our hearts do pull at animals.
Well, but there's also the issue of, self-determination. Mm-hmm. And like our caller Bill said, we want to respect people's choices, whereas with children and animals, we sort of assume the mantle of responsibility. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask all of you about something that came up earlier. And Stephanie, maybe to you first. We talked about the role that substance abuse, untreated mental illness are two big reasons why adult children might mistreat their older parents. What about, Stephanie, homes where abuse has always been a factor, an unfortunate long tradition in a family? Maybe the abused elder abused the child when they were little. How much is this playing a role?
That's a really excellent question, and there has been the beginning of research into that area about this cycle of violence and does it perpetrate throughout the lifespan, child abuse, domestic violence, elder abuse. My understanding, and I would defer to Renee on this, but my understanding is that it's really inconclusive. However, we do know, we have established that violence can be learned behaviors. The way that we treat older adults, the way that we treat others, is learned. It's influenced by our environment, whether we respect older adults or not respect older adults. And so, I think that the data might be inconclusive at this point, but there definitely seems to be the common sense leanings that we have that that violence can and does perpetrate in the family and perpetuate, I should say, in the family as we age and as the situations change. One dynamic that we are seeing and that we are documenting is quite interesting is sometimes you would see that you do see that flip. So the child that was abused may abuse the older adult later on in life as the child grows up. The victim of domestic violence, whether that was the man or the woman in the relationship, that dynamic might switch as they age. So the person who was the victim of domestic violence might now become a perpetrator in later life. So these are all questions that need to be looked at much more. We do see some patterns emerging, but we don't really have a good grasp on that yet.
Well, more for Renee to dive in with her research at UNH. I have one more email I'd love to share with all of you. This is from Tommy in Concord, and Tommy's a little long, so I won't read the whole thing, but I hope that I get the gist of what you're trying to say. My mother-in-law and I, on the 5th of July in Maine, my mother-in-law and I found an elderly man semi-conscious in a sweltering van. We cared for him, gave him water, etc., found out he had Parkinson's disease and was just out of the hospital with a bracelet still on. Tried to contact the Bangor Police Department, but they forwarded me to the Elder Abuse Hotline. I finally got through to the hotline, and they said usually 13 on the phones, but only 2 because of new governor's budget cuts. After being on the phone for over an hour, I was told I had to go back to the PD and file a complaint. I didn't, Tommy says, and I still feel so guilty, but it was made almost impossible by the system to get help for this man. And Tommy, thank you so much for the story. And boy, Renee, I think I'll give that one to you first. The average bystander with a caring heart wants to help someone. It's not easy, though, and sometimes they reach certain stumbling blocks and it just makes it hard for them to help out.
Yes, and this probably should really go to Rachel to talk a little bit about, but systems are not designed necessarily to make things easy. And we're in fiscally bad times. And so you do have one agency saying, well, no, it should go over here. And then that agency not having the funds to follow through. But if this story is true, it's outrageous that no agency would step up and say, we will take care of this gentleman right now at this moment. And you have to wonder about the hospital or the institution from whence he came that would discharge him without proper services. So, you know, bless these people that found him and tried to help. But shame on the system that didn't respond.
Do you want to jump in, Rachel? Sure. Budget cuts, how that's affected your ability to do what you need to do.
Sure. Talk about the reporting system. And I did give the number for that. When we're not open, actually law enforcement does receive our reports, and they're the proper entity to report to under our statute. And also that in situations like that, that if I were to receive a call like that, I would probably say, I think you need to call 911. I think he probably needs to go back to the emergency room. And that at least would have gotten him hopefully evaluated again and hydrated and all those types of things that needed to happen. And then deal with the rest of the stuff as it followed. We also would receive reports by fax. Sometimes people walk into our office and report. Sometimes they use our web mail system, and we would certainly respond to something like that.
And again, we've got that 800 number that you read earlier, Rachel, on our website, nhpr.org. Tough issue. I want to thank you all very much for being here. Stephanie Eliason, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Stephanie Elias, an elder rights team lead at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and L. Renee Bergeron. It was good to meet you. Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
L. Renee Bergeron, Associate Professor of Social Work at UNH, and Rachel Lakin, thank you also for being
here.
Thank you. Rachel Lakin, Adult Protection Program Administrator at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. In the state Senate, Chuck Morse is officially in as president, while Jeb Bradley ends speculation he'll run for statewide office. The Northern Pass Project makes its case in new territory with a public meeting in Concord. And New Hampshire home prices continue to rise, up 23% over last year. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show is next at 10 o'clock here on NHPR, where we get support from UR members. And support also comes to us from Hinckley Allen Attorneys at Law, who believe a lawyer should always understand your business. More information about Hinckley Allen and the clients they serve is online at hinckleyallen.com. And from New Hampshire Orthopedic Center, keeping bodies in motion, on the web at nhoc.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVS Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
Good morning, it's 10 o'clock.
WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. In Stockholm yesterday, President Obama called the proposed military strike in Syria a test for Congress and the world. In Washington, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee approved a resolution authorizing limited U.S. military action in Syria. But at a hearing before the House committee,